all have the occasion to get really stressed out about running out of champagne at a party, but you know what stresses me out even more? Running out of coffee. Especially now that I'm accustomed to drinking quality, fresh-roasted coffee all the time. That's right, you know I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, but best of all, they deliver this fabulous coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto. They even offer autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never feel the sinking panic of watching your fresh coffee supply dwindle before you have a chance to return the key to the coffee cellar to your patsy Nazi husband. Make the switch! It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
That was a mighty fine sponsor there, Bev.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi there, movie maniacs, and thanks very much for listening to the Next 100 Project, the weekly classic movies podcast. If you prefer that we don't spoil this movie for you, shut your ears now, and then just let the thing play out and do nothing, wash dishes, go to work, what have you. My name is Ryan Ellis, and with me is the woman I would never pimp out to a Nazi, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Well, depends on the price. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Notorious. In the 20 years between Rebecca in 1940 and Psycho in 1960, Alfred Hitchcock, made 24 movies. What are the only 2 years in those two decades that he didn't release a film?
So I did not realize before researching for this trivia question just how prolific Hitchcock was. Even in the silent film era, well, I guess when he was working in England, good God, the man just directed dozens and dozens of films. No wonder he became a master. He truly never stopped making films. But the answer to the question is 1952 and 1957. And he's so prolific that I wonder if maybe you know something I don't about why he didn't make films in those years.
I don't. But I will add this little bit, because you're right, those are the 2 years, 52, 57. He also put out two movies in a single year in that two-decade span 5 times.
That's incredible.
So he averaged more than one a year in 20 years. And he was not young by the time we got to 1960.
He peaked in his career really close to the end of his career.
He got better as he went along. We've covered 4 Hitchcock movies before this for the Top 100 Project. And I was thinking about this earlier, that some of the directors who had movies on the Top 100 Project, John Huston and Hitchcock are the first two I think about who had movies that were towards the end of the show, meaning the higher ranked numbers. Hitchcock had Vertigo in the 60s the first time, and of course it went way up on the second list, and then North by Northwest, and then Rear Window, and then Psycho. John Huston was even higher, actually. But in both cases, you got guys where it's one, and another, and another, and another. They both were involved in 4 AFI movies, and all in the top, well, I guess 66 for the first list for Hitchcock. And when you make that many movies, Huston did too, maybe that's why there's all these great choices beyond the ones that were actually on the Top 100 Project list. The Next 100 Project's 32nd film, Notorious, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. After premiering 70 years ago in August 1946, I mistakenly said 60 years ago in last week's podcast, RKO Radio Pictures released it in September of 1946, and it made a mint. But Bev, remind people who aren't familiar with this film with this skinny.
Cary Grant is T.R. Devlin, an American intelligence agent charged with handling Ingrid Bergman's Alicia Uberman, an expat daughter of a Nazi war criminal who's turned spy for the Americans. She must infiltrate the Nazis' plans through Claude Rains' Alex Sebastian, an old family friend who happens to be in love with her. The rub? Devlin and Alicia have fallen in love with each other.
And Sebastian is a dirty, dirty Nazi.
Which you have to remember in order to stop feeling sorry for him, because he's otherwise the most sympathetic character in the film.
Agreed. Or, in a nutshell, sucker Nazi is betrayed by his two-timing whore wife.
Accurate.
All right, a few numbers before we get going. The Rotten Tomatoes critics liked the picture a lot. 97% of the critics liked it, 36 fresh, only one rotten, and 91% of audiences, and it is on the fringes of making the IMDb's top 250. It was on there when I looked about 2 weeks ago, and right now it's not, And it was seventh at the 1946 U.S. box office. The Best Years of Our Lives, which we covered way back when, and it was the Best Picture winner of 1946, was number two in 46. But the audience, our lovely fans who've been sending us mail lately, we've not responded to or we've tried to keep up with, want to know what Bev thinks of Notorious.
The first half does nothing for me. But once Claude Rains joins the ensemble, I was all in. The romance left me cold, but that suspense of the party scene is just Hitchcock at his very best.
Maybe the suspense scenes put this over the top, but the romance scenes, even though it's lauded for those two, and the infamous kiss, the 3 or so minute kiss, where they do it, and then they don't, and they do it, and they don't, and I say do it as in they're fully clothed and they're just kissing, but that was getting around the code. You couldn't kiss for more than 3 seconds, so they would just do that and they talk. That's pretty famous from this film, maybe the most famous scene in the film. But then, the suspense scenes, and of course, Master of Suspense Hitchcock was known for those way more than anything he ever did romantically. They're what worked the best.
I've been thinking about this a lot because now we've covered, I think you said, this is our fifth Hitchcock film. And I've seen other Hitchcock films as well. I've just never really been a fan. The only one that's ever really gotten under my skin was Psycho. That was the only one where I would say, oh, I really liked that movie. Whereas everything else, I just found something to struggled with, or really they all leave me cold. You know, I say that about the romance, but I watch these movies at an arm's length. I rarely feel really emotionally invested in them. I consistently struggle to believe the romances, and in this more than most, because Cary Grant's character Devlin, he's wooden and he's mean and he's really unlovable. I don't understand why she falls for him unless she's just such a deeply messed up, flawed, and self-hating character that she would fall in love with this man who's so cruel to her.
She's thought of as loose. That's why the movie's called Notorious. It's because of her father, who was a Nazi sympathizer and was convicted as such when the movie gets going. But also because she's thought of as loose. She'll just fuck anybody because she's drinking too much. The movie implies that, too. It's always been this notorious reputation for Notorious that she will bang whoever is needed. And that's why the CIA uses her. But it's also that I think she is booze-sozzled.
Yeah, she has a drinking problem. At the beginning of the film, she's flagrantly drunk at the party. She has that line where someone says, maybe you should cut yourself off. And she's like, we haven't even begun the serious drinking yet. The drunk driving scene, it's very exaggerated.
Oh, hang on. Before they leave for the drunk driving scene, there are bodies strewn everywhere. It's like the scene in Jesse's place in Breaking Bad when he's lost his mind. People are just lying all over the place on drugs in his scene and Jesse's thing. But in Alicia's, they've fallen like statues. They're just completely inebriated beyond belief.
Sleep in these unbelievable positions. Yes. Yeah. And the film is kind of casting a disapproving eye on the drinking. Whereas Devlin stands apart as a sober and authoritarian and really quite forceful about trying to snap her out of her bad behavior after they get pulled over by the cop. I mean, I've already talked about how I struggle with their relationship with
sock,
each other.
Sock, right
okay,
in the face.
It starts with her discovering that he's a cop and being disgusted with him and trying to kick him out of her car. And he takes this father trying to control an unruly child attitude about her where he just tries to restrain her hands. And it's like, are you done karate chopping her off the steering wheel? In this really, really condescending way, which I guess probably didn't come across that way so bad in the 40s. But
the
cherry on top is he knocks her unconscious. He punches her in the face. She never has a shiner. There's never like any evidence of this punch, but he apparently punched her hard enough to make her lose consciousness. And that's kind of passed off as a hangover for the rest of the film. So I really struggled right off the bat with that. What is there to like about this guy? Why would she ever come around to him? I see why she would have been attracted to him in the first place, because he's Cary Grant. I get it, but that scene really just turned me off of him for the rest of the film.
He's playing against type. And I'm also thinking about the most famous movie that Hitchcock has made, according to many list makers, including the Sight and Sound list that had Vertigo so highly ranked. Vertigo, and these movies share a lot of things in common, Hitchcock often had cold male protagonists take advantage of the woman, even though he's thought of as a misogynist or sexist director. Maybe he didn't sympathize with the women the way that I think De Palma, Brian De Palma, is thought of as the Hitchcock
devotee.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think he did, especially in Blowout, which you've seen, and I think that is a great movie that does sympathize with the woman entirely, and other movies he did too. But Hitchcock could be criticized for not having any kind of sympathy for his women, because we know that behind the scenes he was trying to fuck so many of them. especially the hot blondes, including Ingrid Bergman. But Devlin is not the Cary Grant we had known from before, and certainly that we knew after this. 1946, he was certainly famous. He'd been making movies for a long time. He got even more famous after this, as he made so many other romantic comedies and mysteries and thrillers and dramas and you name it. The guy made every kind of movie there is.
He's a huge movie star, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he is the cold bastard. We see the back of his head when the movie's begun. Maybe because the notion is it's Cary Grant. You don't have to see his face until you really need to, which is in the car right before they get pulled over by the motorcycle cop.
And you're supposed to be watching that scene from his point of view, which was to say you're supposed to be watching that scene from a sober, judgmental point of view.
The government man who's using this woman right from the very beginning. But I bring up Vertigo because Scotty, Jimmy Stewart's character, is obsessed with Kim Novak's character in the film. So they don't compare directly, but they have an awful lot of things in common.
For some reason, I've been thinking about this all week, trying to just really sort out what it is about Hitchcock films that really rubs me the wrong way. Particularly the ones we've seen, which are his most celebrated films, and let's talk about Vertigo. Half of the film, second half of the film, is really devoted to punishing Kim Novak for something that she was maybe not peripherally involved in, but certainly not the mastermind of. The villain of that film is the husband who hired her in the first place, but we never really see him. The whole point is that Hitchcock has this passion and this obsession with sadistically torturing his flawed female characters. Flawed and, I would say, poorly drawn, because I don't think he really writes his female characters in a realistic way, or at least includes flaws in their characters that don't seem believable or drawn properly. But he has this fantasy that he plays out over and over. He casts the most beautiful women in Hollywood who are almost singularly obsessed with the male stars of the film, who consistently show them as little interest as possible and make them chase them while they push them away and are super cold and mean. Every time the woman has any cause to be punished, perhaps she's a thief, perhaps she's a lush and promiscuous or has a Nazi father, perhaps she just commits the crime of, in Rear Window, having a frivolous career.
Being otherwise wonderful.
Being otherwise, like, way out of his league, then there seems to be this pleasure, this fantasy fulfillment of a borderline mediocre man being pursued to the point of humiliation by a gorgeous woman that's out of his league.
What if that's Hitchcock maybe bringing his men down to size, too?
Really?
If you want to call him misogynist, I don't disagree with that. But you take Jimmy Stewart, who physically is not the ideal person, and then Cary Grant, who is, but he's a cold asshole in this. North by Northwest doesn't really have romantic motivations for a while in the picture. And when he does, he's this frivolous ad executive anyway. So you sympathize with him, you like him, but he doesn't do an important job for a living like Devlin does in this picture. But in this picture, he's a fucking jerk. Jimmy Stewart has an important job. He's a retired cop and he's a detective, but he's Jimmy Stewart. He's not the obvious romantic love interest. He did a lot of romantic movies, but he's Jimmy Stewart. And I love the guy, but he's not Mr. Handsome, Mr. Awesome in that kind of way. And he's also too old for Kim Novak, as Cary Grant would have been if he'd played the character in Vertigo. When Cary Grant played him in North by Northwest with Eva Marie Saint, he was too old. Maybe that's Hitchcock's way of also undercutting the men, because he was Mr. Mediocre, beyond mediocre. Hitchcock was a big fat blimp.
So, of course, he had the fantasy that even though he was a big fat blimp, he was a powerful man, and mm-hmm. he could get these starlets to capitulate to his demands.
He wanted to be Cary Grant.
Yeah, I'm sure some of them capitulated more than others, but it's a well-known fact that behind the scenes, he was absolute sadist to his stars.
And he wanted Ingrid Bergman in this picture, but she managed to find, as did Janet Leigh on Psycho, a way to rebuff him and not pay the price the way that Tippi Hedren did with the Birds.
Mm-hmm. Another film where you see a woman who's single and free and suffers for the entire mm-hmm. film. I think he had a thing about watching his female starlets suffer. And also a thing about the overbearing mother. That's obviously a consistent yeah. theme. A lot of people like to talk about that in Hitchcock, that he persistently writes overbearing mothers. And apparently Notorious is one of the first great examples of where the mother was cast. She has a speaking role. And I'm talking about Alex's mother, Claude Rains' character, who doesn't come until the second half of the film. But she's an overbearing kind of Lady Macbeth-style mother. He has this emasculating relationship with her.
Leopoldine Constantine, this was her only American film and her last film, period.
Hmm.
And another case where the actress mother is only a few years older than her actor son.
I wondered about that.
North by Northwest, Cary Grant's what's her name again? I forget her name. But the woman who plays his mother is about 10 or 12 years older, maybe 8 years older than he is.
I can't remember how much older, or was she even younger? Angela Lansbury. I can't remember the name.
Lawrence Harvey.
Yeah.
Both the same.
In Manchurian Candidate, they were almost the same age. Mm-hmm. Although, in defense of that casting, she really looks quite a bit older than him.
Mm-hmm. That's way more of a Hitchcock thing than a John Frankenheimer thing, anyway, because Hitchcock did that over and over again. And yes, the mother character that he perfected, Claude Rains, let's get into him.
Oh, loved it.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Casablanca with Ingrid Bergman, actually, and then Lawrence of Arabia. But if Sebastian wasn't a Nazi, you'd actually feel sorry for him.
I feel sorry for him, even though he is a Nazi. I mean, say he's a Nazi, and I am not condoning Nazis, but he is being a patriot.
That takes a strong stance.
I take a strong stance. I'm very brave, and I'm saying no to Nazis. But he is being a patriot. He's trying to support his country that just lost a war. You can at least understand where his motivation comes from. You never see him do anything really outwardly racist or terrible or anti-Semitic. We don't ever learn that he did anything detestable in the war. And I actually think that's pretty important, because the fact is, Hitchcock never gives us any really good reason to hate him other than the fact that he's from the enemy country, mm-hmm. and that he's fighting for the enemy country.
He also poisons our female lead that we love, Ingrid Bergman, who was already a star and had been for many years, Casablanca especially.
If you made this movie from his perspective, it would be 1,000% justified. She would be a way worse villain if you made that movie than he is. He is, without question, a better boyfriend and husband to Alicia than Devlin is, and I suspect ever could be. He's very kind to her. He certainly loves her more than Devlin does. He deserves her more than Devlin does in many ways. And he's being patriotic to his country. You could argue that Alicia has betrayed her country. She is a true traitor to Germany, to her father.
Well, is she American? I guess she's maybe an expat. Because the Americans are using her, so she must be some kind of citizen of the country.
I guess they're trying to pass her accent off as German.
She is Bergman Swedish, was Swedish.
Yeah, they never really outwardly say that she's not German, but I guess we're just supposed to assume her accent is German. Her father was German. But back to Alex. I need to take this opportunity to absolutely praise my favorite thing about this movie, which is Claude Rains' performance. He has this impeccable control over his emotions. You know, he's not a really emotional guy. Even in that amazing moment when he leaves the key ring out.
The wordless montage.
Oh!
Not really montage, I guess, but the wordless sequence where he figures out that she's betrayed him.
And he so subtly performs the suspicion, where it's just a look, or that flash of realization, and the moment when he finds the key in his key ring again, and he knows there's so much control in that performance, there would be so much potential for him to be campy, especially with the relationship with his mother. But it never is. It feels believable. That sympathy you have with him as a villain, to me, adds miles of depth.
Had they actually managed to poison Alicia properly, rather than Devlin saving her at the end, it would have been, "Mother, no blood! No blood!" She's just dead on the bed. Psycho reference.
And in that moment, in the last shot, when Devlin rescues Alicia from...
Well, the last sequence, really.
Yeah,
the
sure,
whole thing.
Sure.
He goes in her bedroom, takes her down that long staircase. I love Woody Allen talks about this in Manhattan. Well, the character, I'm sure Woody Allen actually feels this in reality, because I know he's a fan of certain films like this. When they're going down the staircase, "I'm always so worried they're going to get cooked." I'm kind of with them.
Yeah.
That's great suspense. You've seen the movie many, many times, and you feel like, this is the one time, as they go down that checkerboard floor, as the hip would say.
Very Canadian. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a nice reference to the hip, who recently did a great concert in Canada. That floor that's set up like it's a checkerboard or even a chessboard.
Yes.
And the main landing of the Sebastian home, where the Nazi guys are watching as this is going on. It's like, okay, why is Alicia, who we barely know, it's our friend's wife, being taken out by this guy who we barely know, Devlin. They don't know he's a CIA guy, or at least an American government agent. Oh, the chess game is in place, because Devlin's been playing a chess game with them, with his superiors making him a pawn in a way, too. But then the Nazis are making Sebastian a pawn, and you know that when the movie's over, that guy is dead.
Yeah, they set it up earlier with the other guy that makes a fuss over the wine bottles where the uranium is hidden. He dies. So we know Claude Rains is not long for this world. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I never actually went back and rewatched this shot to be sure, but the last thing we see in the film is Claude Rains with his Buddy's behind him being like, why not a close up. Yeah, it's more of a wide shot.
Yeah, it's one of the great endings in Hitchcock's career. One of the only really good last moments, because sometimes the climaxes were wonderful, like in Psycho with Norman Bates coming down the stairs, that look on his face. I talked about that in the Psycho podcast. One of the most skin crawling moments I've ever seen. I've watched that clip so many times of Anthony Perkins with the wig and the knife in his hand. But then the movie goes on another several minutes. And the guy explains he's a cross-dresser and all this, and it ruins all the suspense. But then the very last couple moments of Psycho are great, but they kill it by having the explanation. Vertigo has a great last few minutes, but I know we talked about this in the podcast, about how the religious figure comes out, and then the Kim Novak character just falls out of guilt, I guess. The last shot is wonderful, of Jimmy Stewart's character has lost his woman again and doing that sort of Jesus pose, but not blatant Jesus pose. That's pretty good, but it doesn't really work as well as a lot of the other endings in any movie could have. Hitchcock, this has been said before, I think it was Salon, but somebody wrote a post about this a long time ago, over and over again, made good movies, maybe even great movies, but his last shots, his last moments, maybe Rear Window, one of my favorites, did it really well. But over and over again, he fucked it up, but not in Notorious, because you've got that suspense when Devlin's taking out Alicia, and they get in the car, he tries to go along with them, Devlin locks the door, and they drive off without him. Alex, can you come up here, please? We need to talk to you, and you know he's dead. It really puts the nail in the coffin that the last moments with the villain of the movie, essentially, but you sympathize with him because he's about to be killed for something that he was a sucker for. Like I said, sucker Nazi, betrayed by the two-timing horror wife.
That brings us to probably the most prominent theme of the film, which is trust. Should he trust Alicia? He trusts her too quickly, whereas Devlin is very reluctant to trust her. She puts so much trust in Devlin, who is cruel to her. She sleeps with and marries a man that, for all we know, she loathes. She certainly loathes what he stands for. She's a loyal American and did not support her father, loyal to her father's beliefs. And she does it all for Devlin because she loves him and she trusts him.
She is blackmailed a little bit, though, too.
What do they blackmail her with again?
The notion that she's notorious. And the commentary is by a woman who's just awful because she reads commentaries. She did this, I forget her name now, but on Notorious and The Lady Eve. Maybe she's not bad as an actual film critic, but she just reads the commentary the whole time and is dull as fuck. She says over and over again, the notorious woman of affairs. And I think they literally mean affairs, but then also political affairs. So that's why she's blackmailed.
Yeah, but I don't understand, how does that even have a connection to her working for the government?
Because they can blackmail her because she was loose.
They're blackmailing going to expose her.
I guess, but also because she's tied to a Nazi, even though she had no true sympathies with this father that was a Nazi.
But that all was already out in the open. What were they threatening her with?
Ruining her reputation.
She had a ruined reputation. That's why she was drinking her sorrows away at that party and openly hitting on a man that she had just met. So she didn't seem like she cares about her reputation. I kind of got the impression that it was more that he lured her with the patriotism that he knew she felt.
And also the power of his cock. Because he is Cary Grant, and they are kissing in Brazil. And by the way, one of the ties to this movie, I don't know if Boys from Brazil with Laurence Olivier and Gregory Peck, which was made 32 years later, in 1978, I think it was, had anything to do with this movie, or if they were inspired by Notorious. But that's set in, obviously, Brazil, as is this film.
Well, a lot of Nazis did flee to South America to escape the war crime charges.
Mm-hmm. When they get to Brazil, it's very early on. It's that famous kissing scene where she's into Devlin so quickly. We've never seen any reason for her to want him apart from the fact that he's Cary Grant, Mr. Smooth, Mr. Cool, Mr. Awesome looking, although he becomes cold later on. Now, that is something that is reprised, and we're going to talk about influences. There aren't a ton of influences maybe from Notorious, but one of the big ones is a huge hit from 2000, Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah.
Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise's character, has to pimp out his girlfriend, his love interest, he's into her big time, Tandy Newton, to the enemy, Doug Ray Scott. Same kind of idea where I have to give you over because they're telling me I have to infiltrate you with this guy to get what we want. But I love you myself and I can't admit that. If you don't like the movie, I grant you that. Or if you don't like parts of the movie, I grant you that. But it's a very important point early on. Devlin is into her. I think he's not faking anything in the sequence that people talk about. The long kiss. Or the kiss and they talk and the kiss and they talk and the kiss and they talk. But then he goes to the meeting with his bosses, Louis Calhoun. We saw him not that long ago in Blackbird Jungle, and he was in Duck Soup as well. he's not really a bad guy, but he's just this callous American CIA or whatever the hell they called it back in the 40s guy who's trying to just give this guy an assignment. One of the key shots in the whole movie might be this one moment where the champagne bottle is sitting on the desk of that guy because Devlin's forgotten it because he's been told, oh, you've got to marry off the woman that they don't know that he is into her, but you're into her. You probably want to sleep with her, maybe even more, maybe even marry her. But you've got to marry her off to a Nazi. And I think Devlin's heart is broken, and maybe that's one of the reasons why he's so cold. I'm not excusing the character, but I think that's why it happens.
I think he's probably bothered by just how good she is at faking it, how quickly she seduces and ends up getting married to Alex.
Another example of actors acting. I've talked about that a lot in the project. Alicia certainly does it with Alex because maybe she doesn't dislike him early on, but then when he starts poisoning her, of course she must, obviously.
She never disparages him. She never says one bad word about him.
Because he obviously loves her. Alex has to act when he discovers that Alicia is screwing him over and then he and his mother are poisoning her, so they've got to pretend like everything is normal.
And it's not like they have a ton of options. They talk about it on screen and they say, we can't expose her.
Or we're because dead.
That exposes his own stupidity, that he could have fallen for this. So they have to do away with her in a way that looks not suspicious.
Mm-hmm. And then Devlin has to act like he's not in love with somebody that he very clearly is in love with.
Mm-hmm. So there's lies on top of lies. There are people playing parts on top of parts, and everybody has to pretend.
And all of it is because of the Cold War that had started between the Russians and the Americans, even though this is about German, or at least Nazi characters, but the Russians and Americans, and anybody really, I suppose, in the Cold War. We always think about those two major countries, but a lot of people were involved in the post-war thing. There's a lot of blood was boiled at that point. It wasn't like, the war's over, we're all fine now. Uranium was a big deal. Atomic bombs were a big deal. It was all fresh on people's mind in 1946.
I read a review that pointed out, had the movie been made even months later, had they written the script months after the film had come out, then Russians would have been the villains, not Germans. But because it came out in 1946, I guess there was still this looming threat or this worry, this concern that the Germans could rise up again, that they weren't actually a thwarted villain yet.
They started shooting a month after VJ Day.
So even when they wrote the script, they didn't know that they were going to win the war yet.
Right. Well, it wasn't necessarily fully over, but they would have thought that, well, is it really truly over? Look at the wars we have now. How do you ever know if a war is over? You don't.
They knew that war was over when it ended. At least for the time being, in a somewhat major way.
One of the last decisive wars that's ever been would be World War II.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
It even starts off, and this movie does, with an unnecessarily specific time and place, just like in Psycho. It does make a little bit more sense, though, because Hitchcock really dealt with these kinds of themes. Bigger subject matter, more important, grander, worldwide than he usually dealt with. It was more about, and that's fine, I liked Hitchcock films generally, but they were more about a few people dealing with mother issues, like in Psycho, or crazy killers who want to just kill innocent women who've done a little bit something wrong but don't deserve to die for it, or the Vertigo stuff. North by Northwest is actually a big issue. Then again, that gets into Cold War stuff too, doesn't it? But generally, Hitchcock didn't deal with huge themes. It was more about Strangers on a Train, one of his more famous films, where it's just, I'll kill your trouble and you'll kill my trouble and then no one will know because we're not tied to each other.
Violent, but an intimate kind of violence.
Yeah, very small scale, not huge cast. And that, of course, plays into Hitchcock's desire to shoot in a studio with a relatively small cast.
It's true. He did love to return over and over to close people committing violence and terrible things to one another.
Well, at least he doesn't have Devlin undress Alicia like Jimmy Stewart does to Kim Novak in Vertigo. That's a plus.
The way he is to Kim Novak is, in at least in my mind, in my remembrance of that film, is crueler.
Before he even knows that he's been played, he's cruel to the character, and then when he does know, he's very cruel to the character. It doesn't end the greatest way. Maybe that's why people love the movie so much and why it's gained in esteem. I think people were freaked out by it in 1958 and the years that followed. But as the decades have rolled on, they've started to catch on more to it. We like the movie, or at least I like the movie, a fair amount. It's not my favorite Hitchcock film. It's not the one I would want to watch over and over again because it is really slow early on. One of the best looking films of all time. Great use of color. But just like in Vertigo with Notorious, someone is in painful sacrificial love. Kim Novak's character in Vertigo is willing to sacrifice because she's grown to love the Jimmy Stewart character, even though she's been playing him. She's been hired to be an actress. Alicia Huberman has been hired to be an actress, effectively, and she's actually fucking and marrying a guy to do that. But she's in love with Devlin, and we see it in the scene where they're kissing. She's willing to sacrifice her life for a cause. Devlin doesn't seem to be quite as willing to do that, but at least he saves the woman in the end. But she's the hero, and he's not.
Agreed. Hitchcock likes to punish the characters who are the more devoted in a couple. And you could say the same about Alex. He's the more devoted and he pays with his life. Anytime you love somebody more than they love you in Hitchcock film, you suffer.
Well, even in Psycho, Janet Leigh loves John Gavin's character more than he loves her. At least he seems to. Now, the one that actually hurts her is not him, but she's the one who dies. I love when directors, writers maybe too, but directors go back to the same themes, but do it maybe a little differently, originally, different angles on, especially as they get older, they see different angles on this. They feel differently about the world and about themselves, but the same themes are there. Spielberg had themes, Scorsese has had themes, Hitchcock obviously did, John Ford, all the great directors, Bergman obviously had themes that they came back to over and over again. But Hitchcock may be the best example of a director who used a lot of the same things, even in movies that aren't about the same things. Mother characters who are smothering, people who treat each other awfully, the women who are willing to sacrifice, but also are very duplicitous, who maybe even be villains in their own way, but the men who want to love them also hurt them, maybe even get them killed.
That's a great point, and you're right. He finds over and over unique ways to shed new light on these themes that obsess him.
Well, he appears in the movie, as he always did in his film, certainly from, I think, maybe the mid-30s on, when he was still doing English films. And the idea there was they had to have somebody fill the scene, so a director would do that, because I'm on set, why don't I just do this scene? And then it became this whole thing where he was actually in his movies. People know about the Hitchcock cameos. In this movie, his cameo adds to the tension, because he's one of the people drinking champagne as it's running out.
Oh, this device is phenomenal. One of my favorite things about the film.
And people talk about the key. The great Unica key, that there's a story about how Ingrid Bergman kept the key, Cary Grant gave it to her from the set, and then she gave it to Hitchcock many years later to say, it's this good luck device, here you go, Hitch. And he appreciated that. But it all starts out when she takes the key. You talked about before about how we see the visual storytelling when Alex figured out that she had it earlier in the day. The shot that winds down through the staircase. Now, I'm going to take issue with Hitchcock on one thing. He was the one that said about the shot, you've seen it in many films, especially horror films, Castle horror films or Roger Corman horror films, where they'd shoot through the fireplace. And his thing was, whose point of view was that? Well, my answer to that would be, well, whose point of view is swooping down from a staircase that goes into the close-up of the hand clutching the key that she's got? And it's the director's point of view. Yeah. Any point of view in the movie is always the director's point of view.
It's just the cool point of view. Mm-hmm. It's the God's eye point of view. It's the audience's point of view.
The most important point of the whole film. Because the fact that she has that key and lets Devlin in, he finds the uranium in the bottles. They mess that up. They get out of there. Very good improv on his part. I actually was trying to make a move on your wife. So then you got to kick me out of this party. Alex discovers it later on and then checks the whole key thing. But that's the key to the movie, is a key.
Yeah. And let's talk about the champagne, because I think this device is amazing. I can't believe, even during the movie, I thought of this. Why didn't anybody think maybe a party is the absolute worst time to go down and investigate the wine cellar? Because it's the one time that somebody is likely to have to go back to the wine cellar.
But why would Devlin be in the house unless it was at a big party?
But they could have come up with a better plan, but neither here nor there, because in the moment it happens, when they're waiting for their opportunity to go down to the wine cellar and see what's what down there and see what Alex is hiding, they realize the second they run out of champagne, they're going to go down to the wine cellar to get more. So there's this repeating shot of the bucket filled with champagne, you know, with fewer bottles as the night goes on. And it's so effective because from that moment on, when they introduce that conflict, every time you see somebody with a glass of champagne in their hand, you get, like, resentful and you're angry. Yeah. And actually, this is a great callback to the fact that she has a drinking problem. That the movie is giving her a hard time and viewing her drinking problem as problematic. Right at the beginning, it's very obvious, but still, when the kissing scene, she says, let's get a nice bottle of wine. When they meet up, they get drinks. And then, suddenly, that
alcohol is the key thing.
It turns on her, and while she is an overconsumer of alcohol, she suddenly finds herself in a room full of people who are drinking all the champagne, and she's terrified that they're going to drink all the champagne, because the second they go downstairs, she's going to be found out, which is actually what happens. If he doesn't have to go downstairs to get more champagne, she wouldn't have gotten busted.
The set piece in the whole film. And one of the reasons why it wasn't the throws list, absolutely, like the ending. So as for the ending, I think we talked about it already, we jumped ahead there. But what did you think about the tension of the last maybe 10 minutes of the film? Because I know you weren't into the first while of the film. When I first saw this movie, it had been talked about forever. I finally rented it after, I don't know, AFI lists had come out and all the rest. And I liked it, but I think I may have been in line with, I think, what you're going to say, which is the first little while is slow to get going, and Devlin's an asshole. But then when the key stuff happens at the party, and then you see that they're poisoning her, and then, of course, the climax. I was all in. Were you also all in?
I was. Even as much as I couldn't get behind the romance, the moment that he just marches up the stairs and rescues her is cathartic. The fact that he finally chooses her, he chooses to forget everything else, forget her past, and forget the fact that she prostituted herself out for the American government at his request. Doesn't matter. What really matters is saving her from this situation that I helped get her into. And he does it. And as much as I feel so sorry for poor Nazi Alex, I am definitely happier they got away, that their romance will probably carry on for how long, who knows. But that moment is pure catharsis. It is a really good ending.
He's also going against what his superiors would want, because he's not in the case anymore. He may actually be drummed up on charges and then put out of the CIA. I don't think they really make clear what he's involved in.
But what was the government?
But he's out of the government.
Yeah, but what were her other handlers going to do about the fact that she was being slowly poisoned to death? Were they going to let her die?
You know why that checkerboard floor is on the house of the Devlin place? Because they're all pawns. Even the Nazis, but certainly Alicia and Devlin himself and Alex. The three main characters are all pawns to anybody who's trying to resist the Americans, and certainly the American government. None of them really matter as human beings.
Now, the kiss was certainly a scandalous part of the movie, but apparently it was also quite scandalous, the notion, the suggestion that the American government would have prostituted somebody up, Mata Hari style, they always talk about Mata Hari, and do something as dishonorable as pimp out one of their agents, or whatever you might call it.
Especially when another person is interested in her romantically and wants to be with her, and yet he's got to be the one to tell her, that's your assignment, go fuck that guy. But I think,
irrelevant, that's irrelevant compared to the notion that government agents would ask somebody to have sex with a person of interest.
But in the interest of national security, is that not a small price to pay for all of us?
But it's a scandalous thing to suggest that the American government would go ahead with. Do we doubt that something like that would happen if the circumstances call for it? Of course we don't. But in the time when Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was a believable movie...
I could change the sister by being honest. Okay, well, Cary Grant, our big star, he's colder than normal. I guess we've said that already. I think this is the original James Bond, because that guy also used women and was very cold to his lady co-stars.
Okay.
We've seen other versions of James Bond, including Jason Bourne in the modern era. David O. Selznick, we'll talk about him in a second, a little more at least, he wanted Joseph Cotten to play the role. Joseph Cotten from Citizen Kane and also The Third Man. Not as big a star as Cary Grant, of course, but would have been a good choice for the role.
I agree. He's more of an everyman than...
Cary Grant.
Yeah, than Cary Grant. But I really like Joseph Cotten. I could have seen it.
Of the Grant roles we've seen on the AFI list, because he was in Philadelphia Story, he was in Northmore Northwest, he was in, I forget them all right now, but he was in multiple AFI films. What do you think compared to what you've seen on the various films we've watched over the last couple years, performance-wise?
Well, he pulls it off. Despite the natural charm he has, I see how he has that swagger, which works in this film. I think he did a good job as an actor, but perhaps it's too much because I found his character unlikable and next to impossible to root for.
Well, the woman you can't possibly root against is Ingrid Bergman. She'd worked with Hitchcock just a year before in Spellbound with Gregory Peck in 1945, and then she did Casablanca with Bogey and Claude Rains in 1942, the very famous Casablanca. We all know that great picture. What about her performance? Because she is one of the great actresses of all time. I think she's been given her due, but maybe not quite as much due as she should be. Catherine Hepburn is talked about as the great actress of this era.
Yeah, I've heard
that. Is Ingrid Bergman maybe not better?
I've seen Ingrid Bergman in several movies. I would say I've never liked her more than I've liked her in Casablanca.
Well, who does, though?
Well, it's true. That's like a pretty high bar to set. I liked her in this film. I don't know if I would say I loved her, or if there was anything about her that would make me say, oh yeah, one of the greatest of her generation.
I love the idea that in the picture, just the character, not the acting that Grant or Bergman or Claude Rains do. But yes, point of view is everything. Claude Rains' point of view... To hell with Devlin, with Alicia, because they are being so duplicitous and villainous to him.
She's incredibly sympathetic. The moments when she's just throwing herself helplessly at Devlin and she's so in love and she can't help but do anything he asks of her, there is this pure pathos in her face. You really do feel for her, but I'm going to say the same thing about her that I said about Cary Grant in North by Northwest. Neither of them can play drunk to save their lives.
Okay, our man on the scene, Hitchcock, director, producer, not usually given producer credit. He had the big four on the FI list. Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Psycho, and about four or five other classics, including one I've talked about with you. You've never seen it, though, Shadow of a Doubt.
That's right, I've never seen it.
Which people say that he said was his favorite film, and Joseph Cotten, that Selznick wanted for this picture, was the star of Shadow of a Doubt. Hitchcock grudgingly dealt with Selznick, despite many battles with Selznick, but it was kind of forced on him because that was the RKO deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way that studios worked back then. If you wanted to make this movie with this actor who works for us, then you've got to give us this kind of shit. And then it ended up working out pretty well, I guess. But this is when Hitchcock became his own producer because Selznick was so tied up on a movie he made after Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, Duel in the Sun.
Yeah, and he wanted that to be his next Gone with the Wind. So he was investing every bit of time and every bit of money. And he was also such a memo writer. Selznick worked day and night, but he couldn't devote everything he possibly had into everything. So Notorious suffered, but Hitchcock benefited.
Refresh my memory. Selznick was the subject of Bold and the Beautiful?
Bad and the Beautiful.
Bad and the Beautiful. Bad and the Beautiful.
Yeah, one of my favorites. Kirk Douglas. Yeah. The people say that that's
playing
supposed to
be... playing the Selznick cipher.
Yeah, the Kirk Douglas character is a Selznick-esque kind of guy. And when he was down, the people said, well, then just to hell with you, pal. Because they could finally do that after he'd been such a power player for so long. But a good producer. That was the thing. Selznick made good movies for a long time. And people had to accept the fact that they hated his guts. But once they could stomp on him, they did. But you want to say a little bit more about Bergman and Hitchcock's relationship, because Ingrid worked with him twice, in fact, in the span of a couple of years.
Yeah, she was one of his notorious Hollywood women that he became infatuated with. She was his muse for a little while there. But she had the distinction of being one of the few actors, male or female, who could get away with making suggestions to him on set. He was, of course, very particular about everything he wanted, and he usually came to set with exactly the idea of what he wanted to do for the whole film. People were apparently shocked that she could make a suggestion and say, I don't think that this character would do this, I don't think she would look like this, I don't think she would laugh this early or react this early, and he would listen to her suggestions. And it is suggested that is partly because at the time they were making this film, she was actually having a very tempestuous love affair with a war photographer, a la Rear Window, and that she could so strongly relate to the character because she was in this kind of one-sided, horrible affair, and so he actually took her input. Perhaps it was just because he was still trying to sleep with her, but I don't know, knowing his character and what he was known for, maybe that's not the case. Maybe he just honestly valued her opinion.
She paid for her notorious reality for a long time in the 50s and so
on. Oh, yeah.
By being involved with various men. And then she was in Anastasia, won her second of three Oscars for that one. And that was a big comeback for her because she'd been doused out of Hollywood. How dare you fuck other men? I was just reading a few things recently on various websites the last couple of days about the way that old Hollywood was and where they just covered over that people had been pregnant or they were gay or they were with this person or they were not with that person. And the way that Hollywood is so phony in many ways, but in the old days, it was so phony.
And so controlled. Micromanage the private lives of their
stars.
I mean.
Yeah. You couldn't be who you were at all. And it may not be great now, but it's certainly better than it was.
But she was an American, so that probably is part of the reason why she didn't buy into the whole puritanical attitude that Hollywood had. And I think the most notorious thing that she did was have a baby out of wedlock with Rossellini,
Rossellini, yeah.
Who was the baby, was became Isabella Rossellini, who's a
and we
wonderful movie star.
See
now,
here
right?
In a few weeks, the movie we're going to cover.
Boy, she takes after her mother too.
Yeah, Isabella Rossellini. Okay, the writer of Notorious was Ben Hecht, who wrote His Girl Friday for us quite a few months ago, also with Cary Grant in a whole different role. Then again, he is manipulating woman that one too, but he's not quite such the bastard in that picture because that is played from comedy despite some very dark undercurrents of that one as well. And then he wrote Spellbound for Hitchcock and Bergman the year before this. Ben Hecht, a Hollywood legend who's not really thought of as much today as he probably should be. Clifford Odets was uncredited for writing the love scenes, I guess, the whole thing of kiss, kiss, kiss. Let's have turkey. Kiss, kiss, kiss. We'll stay in tonight. Kiss, kiss, kiss. And bring back some champagne. Oh, that's not going to work out so well for us. The movie was 1:33:1. Of course, it's pre-widescreen ratio. It was black and white. It's pretty snazzy looking Blu-ray. If you're going to watch the movie, you probably should watch it that way. The cinematographer was Ted Tetzlaff. This was his last movie, even though he lived another 50 years beyond this, after shooting quite a few pictures before, including My Man Godfrey, about 8 or 9 years before this.
How come he stopped working? Do you know?
I don't know. But here's somebody else I'll compare him to, and you can always talk about this. The editor, Theron Worth, his last movie, lived another 30 years after this. Hmm. What do you think of the cutting?
He has such a great eye for pacing and exactly how long a shot should last. Although, actually, even as I say that, the beginning, that doesn't work for me. Maybe I take it back about that. I mean, when it comes to the tension of the suspense scenes, the party is just perfect. You wouldn't change a single frame, but who knows, perhaps an extended gaze in a lover's direction might have done some favors for the early stuff in the film. But, you know, I can't talk about editing a Hitchcock film without bringing up the fact that Hitchcock edited the film in his head, in the storyboards. Mm-hmm. He didn't really give the editor much to do apart from just put the film together exactly how he envisioned. I don't think there was a lot of back and forth. He really would have just been, now we would say, a button pusher, although I guess it would be a scissors and tape job.
Back then, yeah.
Yeah, but not a lot of creative input, I don't think, if you're working on a Hitchcock film.
George Stevens said that his favorite part of movie making was the editing process. Hitchcock was one of those guys that said the shooting was the most tedious because he thought of the movie ahead of time, and then the editing, which for him was probably easier than it was for most directors. Production was the worst part. You got to sit on set and deal with all the bullshit to get the stuff you know you're going to get eventually, and then you finally get in the editing room and just cut off the heads and the tails of the shots and then put it in the movie.
And we learned recently that Kurosawa was also a very avid editor. That's an editor joke for those of you out there that know what avid is. But he edited his own films, said the work he did on set was just so that he could get to the real work of making film, which was in the edit suite.
People often talk about where they'd like to be in a movie making process, pre-production with the screenplay and casting the actors and maybe a table read with the actors, how interesting that would be. And all those things would be fascinating. But the one thing that you really don't get a glimpse into is the editing room and the number of fights that go on. The director likely should win all those fights because they are the director, man or woman. They should be able to get whatever they want into the picture. But then we've heard lots of stories about how producers of the studio will get involved in the editing process. So it's not the editor who's the problem, or editors. It's the people that are ahead of the director on the totem pole that can say, nope, that's not going to work. That's too long, or that doesn't make sense, or we don't like that, or that person's in the movie too much. That's where the fly-in-the-wall thing for people like you and I, we'd like to be as much as anything. I'd like to be the fly-in-the-wall for all these processes, but maybe most of all for the editing and post-production part of it.
I don't think people ever really think about it or realize just how much a film is truly crafted in the edit suite. I mean, maybe not Hitchcock because he really thinks things through ahead of time. But you're right, there's probably a lot of stories that never get told, and I personally have witnessed a great many fights, exactly like you describe it, between a director and a producer, between people who are invested, and the editor too, and I've gotten invested in a lot of these fights. And it matters. The decisions you make in the edit suite really matter to the end product.
So much of it is the little things that the audience would not think about for a second.
But it would make a difference still. Little touches that the audience doesn't necessarily see.
If you do it right, yeah.
But for whatever reason, a scene just resonates with you more in a way that you can't explain, because maybe the camera just rests on somebody's forlorn expression for that extra second, or that too long second that makes you almost uncomfortable to sit with the emotion, but then it makes you feel something, and that is a decision that's made in the edit suite.
Or the camera is trucked in on Leopoldine Constantine, and then trucked in on Claude Rains when Ingrid Bergman's discovered her coffee's been poisoned. Not quite over the top, but almost over the top.
By then the movie has won you over so much, you can kind of enjoy those campy touches.
Yeah, it is a little campy, because a raised eyebrow might have been enough for her to realize what was going on. Okay, the musician is Roy Webb, who did Bringing Up Baby. We covered that a long time ago on the Top 100 Project. And it was his only film with Hitchcock. Hitchcock's still quite a few years away from using Bernard Herrmann for his composer most of the time. And the costume designer was Edith Head, who worked with Hitchcock so often. And this wasn't, I don't think, her first time, but one of many, many times she did work with old Hitch.
When this film was made, he wasn't quite in his golden age yet. He had made Spellbound, and he made
Rebecca,
other films.
Rebecca,
yes, of course. He still had to fight to get what he wanted. He still had to fight for his budget. He still had to fight for his cast. And his golden age didn't really come until...
That was the 50s.
Yes, yeah.
What a great run that
was.
What
an incredible list.
And it was after Psycho when he started making films less often. The Birds was 3 years later, and then he started making movies way less often, maybe because he finally started getting a little too old and thought, I can't do this as often anymore, and I hit my peak with Psycho, which is maybe not his best film, but it made him so much money, and maybe in a way he felt like, I've done it. I finally hit my peak.
Still my favorite Hitchcock film that
I've
seen.
Yeah, it is for a lot of people. Mm. For me, the most rewatchable is Rewendo, which, by the way, is on Netflix. And we had a recent comment from a viewer that said they love the fact that I recommend TCM things.
Oh, good.
And I didn't do it for this podcast, so I'm sorry. But one thing you should look for on Netflix, at least, is Ruendo, because it's been on there for maybe 2-3 months. Maybe it's only here. We don't get American Netflix anymore. We don't have the option of getting it. So I don't know what's on American Netflix, but Ruendo, if you don't have it on Blu-ray or DVD, then check it out, because it's one of my very favorite movies of his. Okay, The Influence. We talked about Mission Impossible 2 already with a similar storyline where Tom Cruise is hurting Tandy Newton, even though he's in love with her. And there's also a TV movie in 1992. I've not seen that. The themes over and over again. Some of the little ones, some of the big ones. But just like in Psycho, the mother and the son, effectively because the son is the mother, they combine to murder a sinful woman.
Yeah.
And that must have been on Hitchcock's mind. His most famous scene ever, that is not in dispute, the most famous scene he's ever done is the shower scene in Psycho.
Absolutely.
And why does she die? Because the son is doing the mother's bidding because he's insane, and the woman is only there because she's committed a sin by stealing from somebody.
He's not doing his mother's bidding. He is sadistically hurting a woman and blaming his mother for it because his mother is dead.
Right, but in his own mind, he's doing his mother's bidding. That's what I mean.
But he's blaming his overbearing mother for his terrible behavior towards women.
Dare I say he's a psycho? Okay, the awards and list section. The movie was nominated for 2 Oscars, supporting actor Claude Rains and the Ben Heck screenplay, but didn't win either of those. The movie made the National Film Registry in 2006. Fargo, which was only 10 years in, pretty impressive. Not a lot of movies made the list 10 years. Rocky, that was 30 years for that one to have made the National Film Registry, and the Groundhog Day. Good titles. We've covered all of them, and you can look for those podcasts, Fargo, Rocky, and Groundhog Day, on the Top 100 or the Not 100 Project podcast section on the website. Notorious was 86 in the Top 100 Passions and 38th in the Top 100 Thrills. And the thrills that are in the movie, there's not a lot of them, and they take a while to get going, but the whole thing with the key and then the ending, do you agree with those rankings?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you want to rank it as a thriller, then hell yes, those scenes work amazing.
The movie was nominated for the Top 50 Villains, Sebastian, of course, and the Top 25 Music Scores, even though it's not Bernard Herrmann doing the music for a Hitchcock film. All right, Bev, last thoughts on Notorious, the 70-year-old passionate thriller.
Well, my streak of being lukewarm on Hitchcock films continues, but I think I've now been elevated to a Claude Rains fan. Loved him so much in Casablanca, and I've liked him in everything I've seen, but this performance is next level for me.
You're winning, sir. Oh, thank you. Slippery Mo from Casablanca, and he is a good villain.
Shocked!
To find a legal gambling in this joint. All right, well, Notorious is a good film. I'm glad we covered it. I decided to choose it because I thought we should do at least one more Hitchcock. But if we're ever going to do even one more beyond that, it's got to be Shadow of a Doubt because you've not seen it. And that's the one that people say that Hitchcock said was his best film.
I'm sure we'll do more than just that.
All right, compared to the other 4 films we've covered, where would you place this? Is it towards the top or more towards the bottom?
I think it's right in the middle. I would say Psycho's definitely on the top. I think, I'm sorry, but Rear Window near the bottom.
What?
I would place this somewhere kind of near North by Northwest, where it was a movie where the fun parts work so good, you know, the suspense works so good, but the romance I just find completely forgettable in North by Northwest, and it just doesn't work for me. And again, Cary Grant.
How could you say that about me?
Your Cary Grant impression kind of sounds like Katharine Hepburn.
I know, it's the male version of Katharine Hepburn. I'm not shaking my head, but I do have some kind of problem with the voice I'm using. Okay, in 7 days on the Next 100 Project is a movie about pool billiards. It's raw and it's cynical and it made Paul Newman a movie star, The Hustler. Bev knows this movie. We've seen it a few times. I've seen it lots of times. All right, well, the coming attraction trivia for The Hustler. Paul Newman's love interest in the film is played by Piper Laurie. After The Hustler, she didn't make a theatrically released movie, that's important, for a very long time. What was her next movie? And anybody who's a big movie fan probably knows this right off the bat.
Gosh, I guess I'm not a big movie fan because I don't know what it is. If you are also feeling a little stupid right now, you can tune into next week's podcast and discover the answer to that question. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Hey, how'd you know I was going to say that? Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, where you can also find every episode of the Top 100 Project, the Not 100 Project, the Next 100 Project. They're all under that umbrella on iTunes.
A lot of projects.
Those podcasts include each of the 123 films that made the 1998 and 2007 lists of the AFI's Top 100 American Films ever made.
We originally were asked about whether or not there will be another list. We don't know. I don't think so, because that should have been this year.
Well,
by their logic, 98, 2007.
They say it's like the 10th anniversary.
This is 10 years by their logic.
No, it should be 2017. It should be next year. No,
98, 2007, 2016. That's 10 years later by their logic.
Oh, because they called a 9-year break a 10th anniversary?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm waiting for them to come up with something in 2017.
They don't do lists anymore.
I sincerely hope that they do.
They don't do lists anymore. I don't think it's going
to
happen.
Oh, AFI, don't let me down. So, I would just love to see that.
Thank you for the mail, listener, but I don't think they're going to do it because they haven't done any lists for a very long time now. One more thing. Somebody recently asked us also about the BBC Culture Top 100 list for the best films so far of the 21st century. We'll be covering a movie that was very highly ranked on that list in October, so stay tuned for information about that very soon.
Yeah, that list definitely gave us lots of fodder for conversation back and forth and lots of choices that we absolutely loved and absolutely hated and were positively surprised by. It was at least an interesting list to discover what people are holding in high esteem. As much as I resist the idea of ranking films, it does give you such a great launching pad for discussing movies in general.
Why do we exist right now?
Yeah, exactly.
So we rank films in 1998. That's why we have a podcast at all right now.
So go revisit all of those podcasts immediately. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. We are on iTunes. And while you're there, rate us and review us. It helps other people find us. If you would like to reach Ryan and me, we are both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkPlugCoffee.com.
Let's go put some of that coffee inside of a wine bottle and deceive the Nazis. But they might discover us, those motherfucking bastards.
And cut.